Hello, this is Terrence McNally. This week I share with you a couple of my favorite previously recorded interviews, both dealing with the darker sides of human behavior. In the first half hour, I speak with Ben Skinner, author of A Crime So Monstrous, Face to Face with Modern Day Slavery. This interview originally aired in April 2009. In the second half, my guest will be Gabor Mate, MD, author of In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction.
We all know that the world suffers enormous economic inequity, hunger, deforestation, pollution, climate change, nuclear weapons, terrorism, etc. That is not even to speak about the current global financial meltdown. And to those who say that we're not really making progress, I imagine many would point, for one example, to the fact that at least we've eliminated slavery. But sadly, that would not be true. 143 years after the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was passed in 1865, and over 60 years after Article 4 of the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights banned slavery and the slave trade worldwide, there are more slaves right now than at any time in human history, 27 million. According to Kevin Bales, author of Disposable People, folks get rich by using slaves, and when they're finished with their slaves, they just throw these people away. That's the new slavery, which focuses on big profits and cheap lives. It's not about owning people in the traditional sense of the old slavery, but about controlling them completely. People become completely disposable tools for making money. During the 4 years that today's guest, Benjamin Skinner, researched modern-day slavery for his new book, A Crime So Monstrous, just out in paperback, he posed as a buyer at illegal brothels on several continents. He interviewed convicted human traffickers in a Romanian prison. He endured giardia, malaria, dengue, and a bad motorcycle accident. But Skinner says he's most haunted by his experience in a brothel in Bucharest, Romania, where he was offered a young woman with Down syndrome in exchange for a used car. On Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, and media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Currently a fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard Kennedy School of Government, previously a special assistant to Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, Ben Skinner has written for Newsweek, the LA Times, Foreign Policy, and others. He was named one of National Geographic's Adventurers of the Year for 2008, and his first book, as I said, just recently out in paperback, is A Crime So Monstrous, Face to Face with Modern Day Slavery. Welcome, Ben Skinner, to Free Forum.
Thanks. Great to be with you, Terry.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we deal with, so I have a couple of questions to start off. One, how did you first learn about slavery? What first got you interested in slavery? And I also have read in your bios that you are descended from abolitionist stock.
The fuel began before I was born. The abolitionism in my blood began in at least as early in the 18th century, as far as we can tell, when my ancestors were Quakers, abolitionists. They stood on soapboxes in Connecticut and railed against slavery and hurt their businesses that did business in the South at the same time, but that didn't matter because they believed in something. I had other relatives that weren't Quaker, but had the same beliefs. For example, my great-great-great-grandfather fought, not a pacifist, obviously, not a Quaker, but fought with the Connecticut artillery, and very much with the idea that slavery was an abomination, and the recognition in the country then was the only way to overturn it was through bloodshed. And now, after 360,000 Union soldiers have died, after over a dozen conventions, you mentioned a couple, but over a dozen universal conventions, 300 international treaties, there are more slaves in my lifetime than at any point in human history.
Okay, and two things about that. One, just so no one quibbles or that we're not saying – we're saying something which we hope will shock, but – more total slaves How about as a percentage of population, since obviously the population in 1865 was very different?
Sure. First of all, I want to be very clear what it is that I mean when I say the word slave.
Right, a definition.
Absolutely, because the term today is tossed around. If you look up in Merriam-Webster in the dictionary, the first definition is drudgery or toil. It's become this metaphor for undue hardship because we assume that when we assume that once you legally abolish it, it no longer exists.
So it's good as a metaphor, but in fact.
But in fact, as a fact of life, as a matter of reality, for, as you say, up to 27 million people in the world, slaves are those forced to work, held through fraud, under threat of violence, for no pay beyond subsistence. It's a very spare definition.
And whose definition is that?
That's Kevin Bale's definition. I'm glad you asked because I don't give him enough chance to – or I don't give him enough credit. I adopted his definition he's an academic. He came up with the number 27 million originally. Subsequently, that number has been buttressed by International Labor Organization studies that found government estimates of some 12.3 million slaves in the world. That's what governments will acknowledge. Now, if you talk to NGOs in those same countries, they'll say the numbers are more than twice as high. But Kevin did a lot of the academic work that underpinned what I did when I went out, and I wanted to go out and get beyond the numbers.
Right.
And this is the critical thing. I knew that I couldn't go out and count every slave, but what I wanted to do was show what one slave's life was like, what one slave's slavery meant. And in the process of doing that, I met hundreds of slaves and survivors.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, for people that I recommend both books. Disposable People lays out, as you say, the academic, the numbers, the case and so on. A Crime So Monstrous is an investigative reporter rather than academic going – and as I said in the intro, going to where this actually takes place, where the trades are made – and where the suffering takes place and where the survivors eke out their existence.
Right. You know, it's one thing to say, to lay out that definition, to talk about the numbers. It's another thing when I go, as you mentioned, into this underground brothel in Bucharest and I'm offered a young woman for sale who has the visible effect of Down syndrome. One of her arms was covered in slashes where I can only assume she was trying to escape daily rape the only way that she knew how. And that young woman was offered to me in trade for a used car.
And by the way, this was a Romanian used car, wasn't it?
This was a Romanian used car. And it's something that I knew because I'd been working with various elements in the underworld for a couple of weeks before I went into that brothel. And I knew that I could get that car for about 1,500 euros. Now, while that may sound like a very low price for human life, consider that 5 hours from where I live in New York, that's a 3-hour flight down to Port-au-Prince, Haiti, an hour from the airport, I was able to negotiate for a 10-year-old girl for domestic and sexual slavery, and the asking price was $50.
Now, I just want to say that before we went on the air, you asked me, how much do you think you could get a 10-year-old girl for cleaning, cooking, permanent possession, right, and sexual favors, and I said $7,500. And you said, well, they asked for 100, but you talked them down to 50.
You're right. I'm glad you gave me the chance to correct. They asked for 100, talked them down to 50. Now, to put that in context, going back to the time when my abolitionist ancestors were on their soapbox, you could buy in broad daylight in 1850 a healthy male, healthy grown male, for the equivalent of about $40,000.
Now, I want listeners to hear that. That actually, I mean, when I first read those numbers, I was shocked that in fact it was a sizable investment to get a good worker in the mid 1800s.
And this is not to diminish the horrors that those workers would face in slavery. This is not to diminish their dehumanization one bit. It was an abomination then as it is today. But it is to say that in the mid 19th century, masters would view their slaves as an investment, one way or the other. And, you know, just as people beat up their Mercedes when they buy them today, then oftentimes they would beat up their slaves. But here's the thing. When a slave costs $50 on the street in broad daylight in Port-au-Prince, and by the way, this was in a decent neighborhood. Everybody knew where these men were and what they did. When a slave costs $50, these people are, to go back to Kevin Sturm, eminently disposable in the eyes of their masters.
I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Ben Skinner. He's the author of A Crime So Monstrous, Face-to-Face with Modern-Day Slavery. You can learn more. I'm going to give you a couple of different websites. One is A Crime So Monstrous, one word, acrimesomonstrous.com, and the other is freetheslaves.net. And freetheslaves.net is the home of an organization to which you can get involved and work for the real and true abolition of slavery.
This evening, I'm speaking at the Beverly Hills Country Club alongside a survivor of slavery and Julia Ormond, the actress who's been a stalwart abolitionist since she first heard about the issue about a decade ago. And it's a fundraiser for an organization called CAST, which stands for the Coalition Against Slavery and Trafficking LA. On the web at castla.org. The organization that, in my eyes, is the best and most mature regional organization fighting slavery here in the United States. And by the way, this is an issue that we need to talk about, is slavery in the United States, because it's not just in places like Romania and Haiti.
Let's go to that right now, okay. Because that was one of my questions. When we say 27 million and we mention places like Haiti and Romania, if my reading is correct, the biggest concentrations are of slave trade, I guess, Southeast Asia and portions of Latin America?
South Asia in particular.
South Asia.
South Asia in particular. If you were to plot slaves on a map, the biggest number of pins you'd have to stick would be in India, followed by Pakistan, Nepal, Bhutan, that whole area. There are more in India alone, there are arguably more slaves than the rest of the world combined. And yet, if you look at international efforts, if you look at American pressure, India is largely let off the hook, because these are seen in the eyes of Indian federal officials as, and they claim, we have no slaves. They say, these are just poor people. These are the Dalit. These exploitive labor practices, if you're lucky, you'll get that term out of them, are a byproduct of poverty. Let me be clear. The end of slavery cannot wait for the end of poverty. And when we're talking about slavery in India, what I'm talking about largely is generational debt bondage. People whose grandparents took a debt.
Okay, let me just say, we'll get back to the question of slavery in America, but this is important. Remember when we talked a few moments ago about the definition, and that definition was forced to work against their will with no escape.
Held through fraud. Under threat of violence for no pay beyond subsistence. These are people that cannot walk away.
So a huge percentage of them we'll talk in a moment about sex trafficking, which gets its own sort of category. But a huge number of them are in this sort of debt bondage. Describe that.
Absolutely. Okay. I'll give you an example of an individual that I found. I stumbled upon in a quarry in northern India, and this fellow had been enslaved his entire life. He had assumed that slavery at birth. His grandparents, his grandfather, in fact, had taken a debt of 62 cents. And three generations and three slave masters later, the principal had not been paid off one bit. The family was illiterate, innumerate. They didn't keep the books. And three generations and three slave masters later, this fellow, who I call Ganu, he asked me to protect his identity, was still forced to work, held through fraud under threat of violence for no pay beyond subsistence. Since he was a child, this is what he did. This is what he and his family and his children did. They took, along with the rest of the enslaved villagers, huge rocks out of the earth, and they pummeled those rocks into gravel for the subgrade of India's infrastructure, which is, you know, the gleaming pride of the Indian elites. And they further pulverized that gravel into sand, silica sand for glass. There's only one way that you turn a profit off of handmade sand, and that's through slavery.
Very good. Okay, so that's and this happens. His was because of a debt from generations ago. Another way it happens is you go into a poverty-stricken village. Mm. You say, we need workers in the mines, whatever sort of mines they are.
Sure.
Charcoal briquettes, I know, are one of those.
Where I was 24 hours ago in Brazil, it's a massive problem in the north where workers – and here's the thing. Here's what's tricky about this. In many cases, these workers want to work. What they don't want is to be forced to work under threat of violence, beaten regularly, having the women in their lives raped as a means of humiliating them, and then not being paid anything.
And one of the ways is that you pick them up in a rural village away from the mines, you offer them something, you take them to the mines, and when they arrive, they have a debt for that transportation, which is greater than anything they will ever be able to repay.
Absolutely. And if they try to leave, there are men with guns. That's slavery.
Okay.
And in the case of – going back to Haiti for a second, in the case of that young girl, that is a form of slavery that you see in other parts of the world, but you see it in the Western Hemisphere in the greatest concentration, the greatest numbers in Haiti. According to UNICEF, there are some 300,000 child slaves in Haiti.
Does that mean in Haiti or
– That means
originating in Haiti.
That means in Haiti. That means in Haiti. Within Haitian borders there –
So with all the poverty in Haiti, there are people who still can afford 300,000 slaves.
Well, here's the thing. If they're paying $50, then –
That's right.
Although the remarkable thing as I – and I went back last summer with Dan Harris of ABC Nightline, and he said, he was pretty incredulous of my claim. And in fact, it took him 10 hours from ABC offices in Manhattan. But in those 10 hours, by the end of those 10 hours, he negotiated not with one but three traffickers who had offered him three separate girls. And as he put it, the remarkable thing is not that you can get a child for 50. It's that you can get a child for free. And it, because when you go up into these villages, you see such desperation on the parts of the parents. And I did this after that negotiation on the street. I first of all, want to make this clear. I never paid for human life. And I never would pay for human life. I talked to too many individuals who run trafficking shelters, who help slaves become survivors, who implored me. They said, do not pay for human life. You will be giving rise to a trade in human misery. And as a journalist, you'll be projecting to the world that this is the way that you end the problem. If you were to buy all 300,000 slaves, child slaves in Haiti, the next year you'd have 600,000.
Now, first, when you told me that again off air, my brain said, wait a minute, why more? But of course, what you've said is, if you were to buy the 300,000 slaves in Haiti in one fell swoop or 3 months or something, you would then say, hey, business is good.
Right.
And so people would grab more slaves.
Right. And you're talking about introducing hard currency in many cases into a transaction that hasn't involved hard currency in the past. You're massively incentivizing a trade in human
misery. One of the ways that people attempt to deal with this, I think, is called redemptions, is people who will buy slaves their freedom.
Yeah.
What's the take on that? I mean, who's doing it? And what's your analysis of it?
My analysis, and this is on the basis of 3 months spent in southern Sudan, in southern and northern Sudan, but 2 months in southern Sudan in particular, where there was a one particular evangelical group based in Switzerland, run by and organized by an American, who was going in, and first of all, they were raising cash around the states. They'd go to, a Sunday school in Colorado or a second grade class in Colorado and talk about slavery, and they'd say, bring us your lunch money, and if you can get us $50, we will buy a slave's freedom.
Let me interrupt you for one second. Sure. Just to tell people, because it's been a few minutes. This is the voice of Ben Skinner. He's the author of A Crime So Monstrous, Face to Face with Modern Day Slavery, and you can learn more at either the website acrimesomonstrous.com or freetheslaves.net. So this idea of redemption,
This idea of redemption, it was a very effective sales pitch. They managed to raise over $3 million by my calculations over the course of the 1990s. And what they in theory were doing was giving money to retrievers, quote unquote, who would go to the North and through whatever means necessary secure the slaves' freedom and bring them back down to the South. This is slavery in the context of the Sudanese Civil War was used as a weapon of war by the North, where the northern militias would go and raid southern villages, and in many cases they would kill the men and they would take the women and children as slaves, and a weapon of genocide. That much is not questioned. There's no question that slavery was going on, that these slave raids were going on. What I found is that redemption on the ground was enormously problematic. There was scant oversight. They were giving over literally duffel bags full of cash to factions within the rebels that were resisting an ongoing peace process at that point. And what they risked doing, whether through recklessness or through intent, was to essentially become angels of destruction at a time when a negotiated peace was just beginning to take hold. Thankfully, at this point, they've scaled the redemptions back.
So let me just make clear. So what was happening was collecting money in the States to free slaves and, in fact, funding
a rebel movement
in a war and your point of view, potentially prolonging
the war.
Yeah, yeah.
And thankfully, what happened in the end was the death of John Garang, who was the rebel leader, meant that a different faction, the faction, in fact, that this group was supporting, came to be powerful. It was, from my perspective, lucky. That there wasn't any internecine fighting between the rebel factions. But I'll tell you what, from my perspective, from what I could see, what was going on there was largely fraudulent. And what was happening with regards to the actual I went back in and I talked to the rebel officials. I said, well, what do you do with this money? And they said, well, we use this for the benefit of the people. Which begs the question, well, I thought this was being used to buy back slaves. I don't get it.
Yeah.
And they said, well, you know, the clothes, uniforms. They didn't actually say arms. They didn't say arms. But they said, you know, all sorts of things that we need hard currency for. This was their way of getting currency. I don't blame the rebels. Listen, if I was in a similar situation, I'd probably do the same thing.
Right.
The most important point is this, however. The most important point is not the sideshow that this caused, but it's that by the merest estimates, there are still some 12,000 slaves held in brutal bondage in the north of Sudan, and the government has not arrested, has not prosecuted one slave raider, one slave trader, one slave master. And as long as that continues to be the situation, the government of Sudan is in gross violation of international law.
Okay. Let's go back to that question. I'm speaking with Ben Skinner, author of A Crime So Monstrous. He spent 4 years kind of as an investigative reporter in the world, in the underbelly of globalization, as Hillary Clinton has called it, in the world of slave traders. Slaves and survivors of slavery. Let's go back to a point. One of the points we left hanging, which is the distinction between sexual trafficking, sexual slavery, and this other kind of just labor. What does that distinction? How does that distinction show up, and how does it matter?
Well, it's important, I think, to take the type of slavery out of it when we're talking about slavery. When we're defining slavery, it fundamentally, at its core, it's the same in each and every circumstance. We're talking about people forced to work, held through fraud, under threat of violence, for no pay beyond subsistence. If we're talking about forced commercial sexual slavery, in other words, forced prostitution, we are talking about and there's an added element of humiliation, of shame, because essentially what we're talking about is rape. is and in many parts of the world, in many traditional societies, if a woman is raped, it's her fault. And so when women are liberated and try to go back to the villages where they come from, that's it. They will never lead a normal life again. And I think it's safe to say in the United States even, which we assume is a much more welcoming, tolerant society, women who have been in prostitution, regardless of whether it's forced or not, have a difficult time finding normal work, leading a normal life afterwards. So this isn't, you know, there is a school of thought that sexual slavery is somehow worse than other forms of slavery. I actually don't buy that. I think that all slavery is monstrous, and no one slave's emancipation should wait for that of another. But at the same time, if some people are moved to fight sexual slavery and fight sexual trafficking at the exclusion of other forms of slavery, God bless them. As long as they're fighting slavery, and
right.
At the end of the day,
we've got about really about 2.5 minutes left. So I want you to say very quickly what the situation is in America, very quickly, and then spend the rest of that time telling people what they can do.
Sure. If we've been talking for about half an hour here, on average, one more person will have been trafficked into the United States into slavery. We're talking about 14,000 to 17,000 per year are trafficked into the U.S., forced to work under threat of violence for no pay beyond subsistence within U.S. borders. The one great way of getting involved in this fight, particularly right here in LA, is by supporting Cast LA. Cast LA has the oldest trafficking shelter in the country for trafficked women. It has terrific programs that help victims not only of sexual trafficking but of all forms of trafficking. It's an incredibly good, mature organization. On the web, castla.org. Also getting involved with Free the Slave.
Okay. So and the number in America is something like 50,000?
That's the best estimate. Of course, these slaves don't stand in line, raise their hand, and wait for the census to be taken.
Right.
But very briefly, in the few moments that we have left, I supporting Free the Slaves at freetheslaves.net, Cast LA at castla.org, picking up the book and talking about it. You can read about it more at crimesomonstrous.com, and a quarter of my royalties go to Free the Slaves. And beyond that, in this year in particular, this is the time when Barack Obama is setting his foreign policy agenda. He needs to hear from all of us that slavery, the abolition of slavery, the real abolition of slavery, needs to be a part of his legacy.
Very good. So again, the book is A Crime So Monstrous. The websites to learn more about the issue are acrimesomonstrous.com and freetheslaves.net. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at any time by linking to our podcast. You can also sign up to have it delivered to you weekly for podcasts, articles, transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work. Email me at T.E. McNally, one word, T.E. McNally@mac.com, and you can also get on a weekly announcement list that I'm going to tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and more. Thank you, Ben Skinner. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
This is Terrence McNally. Stay tuned for the second half, when my guest will be Gabor Mate, MD, author of In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction. This interview originally aired in May 2011.
As anyone who listens to this program knows, I am a long and consistent opponent of the war on drugs and of U.S. policy toward the users of illegal drugs. I am also someone who advocates for a holistic view of reality, of its challenges and potential solutions, and of holistic healing. And I personally define holistic healing as, first, looking at the whole situation, the mind, the body, the emotions, the spirit, and the environment, and then of treating root causes rather than symptoms, and finally of treating as naturally and as safely as possible. Now, today's guest deals with issues of drugs and addiction holistically. Dr. Gabor Mate, for over 10 years, the staff physician at the Portland Hotel, North America's only supervised safe injection site in Vancouver's downtown east side, home to one of the world's densest areas of drug users. He's the author of When the Body Says No, Understanding the Stress-Disease Connection, and Scattered, How Attention Deficit Disorder Originates and What You Can Do About It, and his latest in the realm of hungry ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction, which proposes new approaches to treating addiction through an understanding of its biological and its socioeconomic roots. Welcome, Gabor Mate, to Free Forum.
Pleasure to be here.
Let me say, first of all, that I saw you speak last Friday night to a packed audience sponsored by an organization called Writers in Treatment, and you covered a wide gamut of things, and we'll just touch on some of them today, but I was very, I had read your book and was very pleased to finally meet you in person and hear you speak. I like listeners to know a little bit about the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about on Free Forum. So tell us a bit about your path to the work that you do today, and be willing to talk about mentors or moments of decision or that sort of thing along the way.
Sure. Well, I'm a medical doctor. Towards the end of my career as a practicing physician, at the moment I'm too busy traveling and speaking and teaching. But I've worked for 20 years in family practice in Vancouver, British Columbia. For 7 years I worked in palliative care, looking after terminally ill people, and for 12 years I worked in the downtown east side, which, as you stated, is one of North America's most notorious and concentrated areas of drug use. My own journey involved not just my observations and experiences as a physician, but also dealing with my own mental health issues, emotional problems, and imbalances. And in the process of coming to terms with my own issues, I began to understand that the medical training I'd received, although, you know, obviously valuable and of great benefit in many ways, also was hopelessly too narrow and shallow in its approach to human beings. And primarily what it comes down to is that the medical approach still separates the mind from the body, and it still looks at individuals as discrete entities rather than seeing us human beings as manifestations of a culture and in a physical and emotional environment. And so I've come to understand that whether we try to deal with cancer or rheumatoid arthritis or colitis or any mental illness, depression, anxiety, ADHD, with which I've been diagnosed, whether we're talking about addictions or any dysfunction of human mind, body, or spirit, we have to understand that we're all connected, that people are not separate from their environment, that we're shaped very much by what happens to us, particularly in our childhoods, and that disease, in the end, is not the source of the problem, it's just a manifestation of a lifelong disconnection, really, from ourselves, and that at the same time, when disease arises, it's also an opportunity for healing, which actually means wholeness, which is to say to get back to who we actually are. So I approach illness from the perspective of what is that illness telling us about the individual at that particular time of their lives, which is not to say that, therefore, I would reject or eschew conventional medical treatment. Often that can be very helpful, but it's not the ultimate answer.
From hearing your response, it strikes me that the three sort of principles that I laid out at the top of my view, which is dealing with the whole person, including the environment in which they are, and treating root causes rather than symptoms, and as naturally and safely as possible, it sounds like we're pretty much in sync.
Sounds like we would be. You know, you have to understand, I'm a medical doctor. I'm not trained in, say, homeopathy or naturopathy or Chinese medicine or Ayurvedic medicine of India. So I know what I know how to do, you know. But I'm also very open to people choosing alternative therapies. As a matter of fact, it's just a reality that Western medicine has got very limited responses to most chronic conditions. And whether they be physical conditions like multiple sclerosis or mental health conditions like depression or addiction, the Western medical approach in which I've been trained, again, is very limited in its responses. So we have to look beyond it. And certainly when it comes to understanding the causes, we really do have to look at people's lives and the social milieu in which those lives were lived.
Very good. I'm speaking with Gabor Mate. This is Terrence McNally on Free Forum. Gabor Mate, as you can hear, is a physician and the author of several books. His latest in the realm of hungry ghost, Close Encounters with Addiction. And you can learn more at drgabormate.com. That's D-R-G-A-B-O-R-M-A-T-E drgabormate.com. drgabormate.com. What does it mean to say the only legal injection site in North America? Could you tell people?
Well, you're referring to a place called Insite, I-N-S-I-T-E, which is administered by the Portland Hotel Society here in Vancouver. It's a facility where people who are addicted can bring their illegal drugs, like heroin or cocaine, without the fear of being arrested, and under supervised conditions with lights and a mirror and a sink where they can wash themselves, and sterile swabs that they're provided with clean water and clean needles, and under the supervision of a nurse, they can inject their substances. Obviously, the benefits demonstrated by many medical studies are that people don't transmit HIV and hepatitis C or other infectious diseases to one another. People don't suffer the consequences of using dirty needles or dirty water to inject with, so that there's less disease generated. The consequences are that there's less injection in the streets, fewer crack vials and drug needles screwed on a neighborhood. And a lot of money is saved because of the preventive aspect in terms of disease transmission. And finally, of course, people, drug addicts who have had a very tough life, they all began life as abused children. That's the universal template for severe addiction, is childhood trauma. These people have a place where they feel accepted and safe for the first time in their lives. So it's a beginning of the possibility of treatment.
Very good. So
all of which means that Canada's conservative government is right now trying to shut down the place.
That was my next question. What is the situation in Vancouver, the city, British Columbia, the province, and Canada, the country, in terms of how this, what I think is an aspect of a harm reduction philosophy rather than a criminalization philosophy, how does this all work?
It is a harm reduction measure, and harm reduction means that you reduce the harm. So naturally, when you prevent the transmission of HIV, you're reducing the harm from the addictive behavior. You haven't treated the addiction, but you reduce the harm from it. That's a necessary first step. On the civic level, on the provincial level, here in British Columbia, it's well accepted, and the governments at all levels are in favor of it. On the federal level, we have a very right-wing conservative government right now. In fact, as I'm being interviewed today, there's a federal election in this country. But the federal government in this country is has shaped itself very much to the right of the George Bush conservatives. And for purely ideological reasons, under the completely false and demonstrably baseless idea that somehow we're supporting or condoning addiction, they're trying to shut the place down despite the demonstrated evidence of economic and health benefits. So it's purely an ideological concern. It's the same kind of thing that until the Obama administration prevented the American federal government from funding HIV programs that involved needle exchange. Now, even though, of course, needle exchange is one of the best ways, clean needles is one of the best ways to prevent HIV transmission. So it's one of those political initiatives that have nothing to do with health or humanity or compassion, and everything to do with the right-wing agenda.
Right, and something to do with politics and the fact that when I look at the war on drugs here in the United States, I see that the evidence makes that approach wrong, the cost benefit analysis, everything, but it seems to have some political cachet out of some tough on crime sort of thing that politicians in their lack of courage continue to perpetuate. And on the other side, there are interests, the correctional unions and the what I would call the prison industrial complex, in whose interest perpetuating that approach goes, while for the rational millions of people who know that it does not, it is not quite as high on their agenda as it is on those institutions who benefit from it. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Gabor Mate. He's a physician and author of several books, including In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction. You can learn more about his work at drgabormate.com, drgabormate.com. Let's jump to the book, in the realm of Hungry Ghost. That's a provocative title, and what does it refer to?
Hungry Ghost is a Buddhist image. The Buddhist wheel of life cycles through six realms of human existence. There's the ordinary human realm, there's the hell realm of unbearable emotion like rage and terror. There's the animal realm of our passions and our instinctual drives and so on. The Hungry Ghost realm depicts creatures with large empty bellies, small scrawny necks, and tiny mouths, so that they're forever hungry and insatiable, but they can never fill that emptiness. And so they go around really haunting their lives, attempting to satisfy this inner void without ever being able to do so. And that, of course, is the realm of the addiction. And it's not that some people are here all the time and other people are there all the time. If we look at ourselves honestly, we can see that we all have that hungry ghost inside of us, one degree or another. And the, you know, the hardcore drug addicts, the hungry ghost dominates their life, but we can all recognize it in ourselves. I certainly can. And so it's a question of why do people get stuck or they gravitate towards the hungry ghost realm. It's because they're attempting to escape the hell realm of unbearable emotion. And if you look at, again, all people who are addicted to anything, it's always based on some degree of loss, emotional loss in childhood, particularly the loss of love. In the case of the extreme addict, it's trauma. And the research in California and elsewhere clearly shows that people who become addicted are traumatized individuals, either because they're directly abused or neglected or abandoned, or because they simply didn't get their needs met as children because their parents were too distracted or stressed or perhaps addicted themselves. But one way or the other, there's a void, there's an emptiness that then we spend all our lives trying to fill, and hence the hungry ghost image.
Mm-hmm. Very powerful. So your sense of addiction, and you refer both to addiction and I think to serious addiction, or what was the word you used that sort of the
biopsychosocial?
Yeah, okay. That,
well, you referred to that yourself.
Yeah.
If that's what you mean.
Exactly.
In your introduction, you mentioned the...
Absolutely. And so there's a continuum here. And so one of the things I find interesting both in your writing and certainly when I saw you speak in person is your reference to your own challenges, your own issues and so on, thus saying that we all lie on this continuum. And it seems to me, speak a little bit just about your own personal experience, because I think, again, that brings things home to people in a way differently than ideas and data.
Well, addiction is a continuum, and some people at the extreme end, that's usually because they suffered more extremely. But in this society, many of us find ourselves on that line somewhere along the way. I certainly do. My own particular addictions have been expressed in two major areas. One has been to work, which has meant that I've been a workaholic physician, which has meant that I drove myself too hard. I ignored my own family's needs. My children didn't have my presence as an emotionally available father when they were small. And certainly my marriage relationship was affected negatively by my workaholic tendencies. My other addiction has been to the purchasing of compact discs. I say addiction, it's, you know, I love music, particularly classical music, but it's not the love of the music that I'm talking about. I'm talking about the need to acquire and to need to acquire more and more and the need to acquire right now, this very second, you know, that having to have that fixed immediately. So the addiction is never to the, in terms of behaviors, it's not to the external target. It's actually to the process of getting. The sex addict, for example, it's not so much sex that they enjoy as the need to be validated by being sexually accepted. So they have to keep proof to themselves all the time that they're lovable. So they're addicted to the hunt and to the quest and to the excitement of the search and the immediate fix. But then they have to go on to the next one because it never satiates and never satisfies. And it's the same with work. It's the same with shopping. So in our society, there's a whole continuum of these addictions. In fact, there's one universal addiction process, as I point out in the book, by which I mean that whether you're addicted to drugs, sex, or rock and roll, it's the same brain circuits that are involved. It's the same emotional imbalance, and it's the same spiritual emptiness that underlies it all. So the targets may vary from person to person, but the process is virtually identical.
Okay, you brought up there the brain circuits. Talk a little bit about the what's going on in the neurotransmitters in terms of addiction, in terms of drug use, and in terms of the wounding that brought that all about.
Sure. Well, if you look at which brain circuits are involved in addiction, you find that these circuits are essential brain centers for human life. We're talking about here about the brain's internal or endogenous opiate circuits, or pain-relieving circuits, which is, say, the endorphins, endorphin meaning endogenous morphine-like substance. These circuits facilitate pain relief, pleasure and reward, and also they help to facilitate our love relationships. So you can see how a person who's lacking endorphins would be desperate for some relief from a lack of love, from too much pain, and from a lack of pleasure and reward. Other circuits involved in addiction are the brain's incentive and motivation circuits, which involve the chemical dopamine, the brain chemical dopamine, which again is essential for human life. Without it, we have no incentive or motivation, no vitality, no curiosity. And all stimulant drugs, for example, elevate dopamine levels. In fact, all drugs work on the dopamine incentive motivation system. And these circuits and other essential brain circuits involved in addiction require, for their healthy development, a nurturing, attuned, calm, balanced, and consistent parenting environment. And to the extent that those conditions are not available to the small child, the brain does not get the environmental input that it requires, and those circuits will not develop optimally. And therefore, people will be prone to try to supplant or supplement those chemicals by outside means, whether through drugs or through these behaviors that can release them in the brain. So the addiction reflects not just a psychological need, but very much a physiological imbalance, which is the result of early childhood adversity.
Very good. I'm Terrence McNally. That's the voice of Gabor Mate, physician and author of several books, including In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction. You can learn more at drgabormate.com, drgabormate.com. Let me ask one other source of can we become addicted to our own stress? Can the unconscious desire to trigger the stress mechanism actually become something people become addicted to? It's my suspicion that that's so.
Well, absolutely. People become addicted to their own stress hormones. The great Canadian, Hungarian-born, actually, like myself, stress researcher Hans Selye, who did the pioneering work on stress in the mammalian body, he pointed out that people can be addicted to their own stress hormones, which is to say adrenaline and cortisol. So there are adrenaline junkies, which is to say that when they're not stressed, when they're not in a highly intense situation, they go through withdrawal and listlessness and irritability, just like any addict going through withdrawal would. So that means people are generating stress for themselves just to feel okay about themselves. And that's usually because they were brought up under very stressed and tense and intense circumstances, and that's what strikes them as normal. So when that isn't available, they just don't feel like themselves.
I mean, that's a very powerful thing. I think if one looks at certainly the society that the U.S. society, Los Angeles society, and so on, it seems to me that that's an insight that's very helpful, actually.
Yes, and it very much describes L.A. culture, I think. And when you want to see how true it is, what happens to people when they don't have those activities that can keep them in a state of tension?
Yeah. What is your sense of the current habituation, at least, if not addiction, to screens, text messages, Facebook accounts, and so on? Do you have a sense of what's happening?
First of all, addiction is always about some external focus. So rather than being internally directed, we're looking for the outside to be excited and satisfied. So the screens provide that, number one. Number two, in this culture, because especially amongst young people, there's such a lack of connection with nurturing adults. Children and young people become connected to one another. And this becomes addictive. So that the addiction to technology is not simply an addiction to technology itself. It's also an addiction to peer contact. So they have to be in touch with each other all the time. Hence all the Twittering and the texting and the emailing and the Skyping and all that. So that it has to do with loss of connection originally to nurturing adults. That's being replaced by a desperation to belong to the peer group. And now we have the technology that keeps people connected to the peer group all the time. Even when they're not physically in each other's presence, they can be in a kind of virtual contact.
Now you
and then there is this specific addiction to things on the internet like pornography and so on. There's news junkies, people who just have to have the news all the time. Why? Because they're empty inside.
And this bit of news, this something promises novelty, promises a little moment of stimulation.
You know, this morning you can spend hours reading about how Osama bin Laden is dead.
Well, right.
There's only one fact: he's dead.
That's right.
All the rest of it is simply verbiage. But people have the need to be engaged with it, you know, for hours and hours and hours because they're lacking something inside. Mm-hmm. They're not getting more information that in any way will help them live a better life. They're simply indulging themselves in the need to be externally stimulated. That's what a news junkie is.
I want to talk in most of the time we have left about healing and solutions, but one more point I want to touch on before we get to that is ADD or ADHD.
Right. Well, what do you wish to address there?
Well, in other words, how does it fit into these same
sources?
Well,
it's not surprising that the first three letters of the word addiction is ADD, because there's a huge overlap between addictions and ADD. Both ADD and addictions involve a lack of the dopamine chemical in the brain, which is what we supply to people when we give them Ritalin or Dexedrine, elevating dopamine levels, so that in both conditions, there's a lack of the incentive chemical, number one. Number two, both conditions involve poor impulse control. People don't know how to regulate their impulses, so they act things out, even though it's bad for them. That's clear about ADD and about addictions. And they both, in my view, represent not genetic conditions, contrary to the dominant medical perspective, but they represent the result of childhood stress. So I have ADD, my kids do. I don't think I passed it on to them genetically. I passed it on to them because they had a stressed childhood, just like I had one.
Right.
And that shapes the brain in certain ways. That research on brain development is not even controversial anymore. Much of it was done or at least collated at UCLA in Los Angeles. But it's still not taught in the medical school. So the medical profession still looks on these conditions as inherited diseases rather than for what they are, which are conditions induced by environmental stress and which can be reversed if we change people's environment.
Right. So that's Dr. Garbamonte. Let's talk in the few minutes we have left about healing, recovery, and when you spoke the other day, you made the point that recovery implies that we're recovering something that may already be there, something that is essential, and now we are recovering it. But what are the solutions for whether it's a child with ADD? Or whether it's a person with a severe addiction, what is the path of healing and solution?
Well, if we understand that we're not dealing with genetically determined conditions, but the impact on brain development and personality and psychological functioning of early experience, and we also realize, again, which is not controversial, that the human brain has got the capacity to reshape itself based on new experiences, then the question we'll be asking is not simply, how do we control symptoms through medications, or how do we change behaviors? But how actually do we promote new development? And that has to do with whether you're dealing with adult addicts or children with ADD, not just in dealing with the symptoms, but also providing them with the right conditions of healing. And the right conditions basically can be summed up as providing for people that which they didn't get in the first place, which is attuned, compassionate, and emotionally nurturing relationships. And all of that is explained in detail in my books on ADD and addiction, respectively. But the essential point to grasp is that in neither case are we dealing with conditions that are written in genetic stone. And therefore, they're reversible. And therefore, we have to be asking ourselves, if we want people to develop, whether they're children or adults, what conditions do we have to provide for them? Because development is always a matter of conditions. You know, if you're a gardener and if your plant is not developing properly, you'll be asking yourself, what condition does that plant require? It's the same thing with human beings.
So are you, in other words, the site where you have helped in Vancouver, that is a harm reduction site and so on, that deals with one aspect of this. Where are these recovery and healing situations taking place? Where can listeners learn more, and what can listeners do if they want to move on these issues?
Well, you know, unfortunately, these are more ideals and ideas than realized practicalities, because the social emphasis, as you pointed out, is on the war on drugs, and all the money is going into fighting something that cannot be fought, as opposed to healing something that could be healed. But, you know, there are organizations and facilities all over the place in California. In San Diego, there's a wonderful organization called Practical Recovery. It's worth checking out on the net.
Very good.
There's an organization called Smart Recovery. You look it up, smartrecovery.org.
Very good.
There are groups and therapists and support institutions or support facilities all over the place, but, you know, I don't have access to them all. But the point is, you have to keep looking. And the point is that you have to keep, you know, and then, of course, the 12-step groups, which are, I don't think they have the whole answer, but they can provide a lot of help as well. If people just understand that the capacity for wholeness and health resides inside them, that if they keep looking, they will find the help they need.
Very good. The book is In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction. The website to learn more is drgabormate.com, drgabormate.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have that delivered to you weekly. You can do either of those things at iTunes or at terrencemcnally.net. Same website is aworldthatjustmightwork.com. You can sign up there to get my weekly announcements on who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and some background. You can also do that by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com. Thank you to Devin Jordan, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi, and Mark Maxwell in production, and Matt Perez in traffic. And to you, my listeners, I look forward to being with you again next week. Thank you so much, Gabor Mate, for making the time this morning and for the wonderful work that you do.
My pleasure to speak with you, Terrence. Thank you.
Very well.
I'm David Pakman, host of The David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel. Check out this clip from my show. Jeb Bush, according to the New York Times report today, possible 2016 candidate. This is just so funny. He listed himself as Hispanic on his 2009 voter registration form. You know, Louis, I am officially Hispanic. Whatever it means to be officially Hispanic, I've been told I'm officially Hispanic, even though I am of Eastern European Jewish ethnicity. I was born in Argentina. I was raised in a Hispanic culture, so I am considered Hispanic. But a lot of people tell me, you know, David, you learned English early enough, and because of your skin color, you present as someone who's just a white American. And I understand that, right? I understand that because I was lucky enough to learn English at an early enough age, I don't have an accent with most words. What's Jeb Bush's explanation, right? I mean, he speaks Spanish. That certainly doesn't make you Hispanic. His wife is Hispanic. She's from Mexico. That certainly doesn't make you Hispanic. But Jeb Bush selecting Hispanic on a voter registration form.
Either he was trying to make a point or he was lying to get more votes. I'm not sure which one it is. But if you're trying to make a point,
but
either
what
leave
point
that,
would it be?
I don't know that that Hispanic, white, black, that it's all the same, that it makes no difference. I mean,
so let me, if I can, yes. What you're suggesting as a thought experiment, I understand that you're not saying this, is that Jeb Bush feels really strongly about race and ethnicity as a social construct, and mm-hmm. he decides to express that by checking off Hispanic on his 2009 voter registration form.
Just an idea.
Yeah.
Because if that's not it, then either he's very confused and thinks he is Hispanic or he's a liar.
A Bush spokeswoman was asked for an explanation. She could offer none. It's hard to imagine it's a mistake. And at the same time, it's hard to imagine what he had to gain by putting down Hispanic. So this just doesn't make sense. I wonder if Marco Rubio, if he runs, could say he was really offended when Jeb Bush checked off Hispanic because it kind of devalues Marco Rubio's actual story of being Hispanic.
I think this is probably exactly the type of thing we'll see come up in the primaries if I hope it does.
This is we're not even at the beginning of the Republican primary, and it's already one of the funniest Republican primaries that I can remember covering. So I'm excited. Tweet me about this. Twitter.com/DPacman. We'll be back after this. You've been listening to part of the David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel. For full audio and video podcasts, interviews, and more, go to davidpakman.com and check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/thedavidpakmanshow.